Route 616, your home for all fans of Marvel main continuity. Hello, everybody. This is Route 616, episode 47. Pretty wild that we've done that many of these fucking fins. I'm here with my co-hosts. First of all, we got Bill. And
hey.
Then, secondly, we've got the man who could easily be cast as the Vulture and nobody would complain. It's Dan.
Fuck Disney. That, you
see,
know,
I'm not going for fuck Disney right now because they're trolling the shit out of Ron DeSantis, and I love it.
Okay,
that's
you know what?
Fair,
that's
actually
entirely fair. Okay, Disney, you get a pass until you're done with DeSantis. Okay, seriously.
I saw that the other day, and that's awesome.
Yeah.
Literally the day he tried to revoke their special
status.
Government status, they announced that they were doing like a pride event for Disney just to piss them off.
You know what? All their dreams have crashed and burned because they've shut down the Starship Hotel thingy.
Well,
so we don't get to go live the Star Wars experience anymore.
They were talking about pulling that like $16 billion expansion or whatever it was too.
They did.
They did. Yeah. That's the thing I was thinking of. That was pretty hilarious.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One thing I discovered this today, as a matter of fact, about 10 minutes ago, was that while most people on Earth are carbon-based life forms, I just looked at what I've been given to cover this week and realized that Ryan is a sphincter-based life form. Just so you know, people. The fucking crap you guys give me is just painful.
I don't know what you're talking about. All the comics we're covering this week are top-class comics.
They're shite.
Oh, yeah.
Serious shite.
I forgot a word in there. Top-class shit.
Yeah.
Were you exploring the cave into Topographical Man issue of Guardians of the Galaxy? They land on this, like, planet-sized person in the small of his back, and then they journey for a while and enter a cave, which has me really worried.
Okay.
That's great.
I can think of worse things in life.
Yeah, you know, speaking of,
having
let's
to read
into
the whole Marvel in order, that would be fucking horrifying.
Yeah, imagine who would do that.
Yeah. Man, your life would have to be pretty pathetic before you'd want to do something like that.
But not as protective or pathetic as if you're, you know, choosing to talk about reading all of Marvel without actually doing it yourself.
No, no, there is zero pretense here, guys. Anybody watching this, I have not read these fucking comics, okay? And I will not read these fucking comics.
Yeah, no, we
the
brought you in as the
Marvel
straight man. In several contexts.
Oh, the only reason I'm here is because I'm straight. There you go. The only Marvel I read way back when I was actually young enough, the comics we're talking about came out while I was alive, were the Rawhide Kid.
Yes, he is that old.
Right. You know, I would read some of the Marvel
Western
comics. The
Cambrian explosion came out while you were alive.
You know what? You know what?
You relate to the Cleopatra issues.
In another life, somewhere in that infinite universe, there's another dimension where I know these two wankers, and I'm currently standing on top of a hillside with a fucking trident screaming, "Release the Kraken! Kill those two cunts!" Right? That's what I'm doing.
That's probably Earth 1610 or something.
Yeah. Whatever.
And I'm still yelling about how Liverpool can't even beat Villa.
Oh, you can go fuck yourself. At least we got a draw. At least we didn't lose. Jesus. That would have been embarrassing.
Yeah. At least, I mean, nobody lost today, so that's the most important part. But anyways, let's get into this week's comics. We have an Avengers, we have two Strange Tales issues, a Fantastic Four issue, and an Amazing Spider-Man. Some of those are good, even.
No, they're fucking not.
We're going to start off, of course, with Avengers issue number 12.
Oh, titled. Are we?
Yeah. Didn't you know that was the first comic this week, Dan?
I do now.
Titled, This Hostager.
The written. Sausage Earth. Yeah. The Hostage Earth.
Well, with this team,
enunciate.
It is. With this team, it is a pretty much a sausage party. But anyways, this is written by Stan Lee, art by Don Heck, and inks by Dick Iris. Arguably, actually, objectively, the best part of this issue.
They've got Jan when Stan remembers she exists.
Yeah.
Cover art is by Jack Kirby and Chick Stone. We've got letters by Sam Rosen. This is a November 1964 release date, a 20-page story, and Dan is going to have the pleasure of taking us away on this journey.
Oh, yay. Well, okay. Obviously, this story didn't leave a lot of impact on anybody because the write-up's like 4 sentences.
You know what? That's fair enough.
Right? Seriously. But again, just so everybody knows, we're going straight off the Marvel database for this, okay? Because I'm not reading this fucking crap.
Even if you do read them, it's just easier to get it off there rather than trying to write your own.
Yeah, it's better than trying to, you know, freestyle it. Okay, synopsis for this hostage Earth. Oh, dear God. Giant Man believes something dangerous is happening beneath the Earth, but none of the other Avengers believe him, because he's Giant Man and everybody thinks he's a fucking joke.
Yes.
Oh, it's because the ants told him it was happening, and he's like, guys, the ants say something bad is happening. We need to do it. And they're like, what, did someone step on an anthill or something?
Yeah, pretty much. So, Giant Man heads underground himself to investigate. Shortly after, he's captured by Mole Man. More damage occurs, and the Avengers discover Giant Man was correct. So they invade Mole Man's underground base. Meanwhile, the Red Ghost approaches the Mole Man, and they make an alliance. The Wasp frees Giant Man, and the team stops the Mole Man and Red Ghost's plans.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
I mean, this was
literally all they've got.
This was a fight issue.
It was
filler, but it was actually decently entertaining filler, especially for something featuring the Mole Man.
And the Red Ghost.
Yeah, but that was a surprise in there.
I know, that's why I thought it was funny, but it didn't come across that well in the synopsis, because nobody cared.
Nobody cared.
No one cared reading the comic, either.
Nope.
It didn't even come across.
Red Ghost isn't cool without his apes.
It didn't even come across that Red Ghost was like this big surprise that appears halfway through the issue.
Yeah, because it made no sense. He just like shows up underground, and he's like, hey, you want to make a team up or something?
How did this title ever fucking create a multi-billion dollar film franchise? Seriously. I have all the faith in the world in Josh Whedon to be a complete ass. And for Kenneth Branagh to actually make a good film, because he has before and he will, you know, down the road. But, man, just paper thin.
Avengers has never really been good. Like, there have been good events in Avengers, but looking at any of the, like, runs consistently, they're always mid because they don't want to fuck up the status quo for any of the ongoing singles characters titles.
When I was younger, when I was collecting comics, when I was, you know, my early teens, I had a friend who was a hardcore Avengers collector. Now, this is mid-70s. But he was hardcore on the Avengers, and I never understood why. And, I mean, yes, I liked DC quite a bit more than Marvel at that point. And he would always say, well, what about Justice League? And he's like, I hate the Justice League. I think it's crap. Stupidest fucking thing I've ever heard. You know, getting all the superheroes to band together to create some kind of big league. It wasn't until, was it Marv Wolfman who came up with the reboot on the Teen Titans? Anyway.
I think that was Wolfman once he left Marvel.
Yeah, like the Teen Titans reboot was excellent. But the only superhero team-up I ever freaking liked was the Legion of Superheroes. And that was because of the really, really sort of high-end sci-fi elements that would appear in it occasionally.
Dan is a Superboy, Mark confirmed.
I think ensemble books only really work when most of the members aren't also in their own comic.
Which is why Teen Titans went so well.
Teen Titans worked. X-Men, when it's not the initial run before it went into reprints, works for that reason because they're mostly self-contained.
Yeah,
but then
the
something like
fairly well.
Yeah, something like Avengers just doesn't work because they can't do anything in it because they need them to be able to go off and have their own ongoing single book adventures. And so they're like, we don't want to strand them in space for 6 months because how do we explain that they all have their solo titles where they're in Manhattan?
Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, Justice League did work in its own level, even though all those superheroes had their own titles, you know. I mean, some of them had a lot of titles.
I mean, Avengers works in, at times, but...
It'll have
not at
good
the moment.
No,
stories, but, like, I've read up to, I think I'm in 76 with Avengers, and,
sure.
Literally,
that's
there's like
prime Avengers territory.
There's like three good arcs, like really good arcs, and it's mostly events that tie in other stuff, like
other titles. Yeah,
yeah, like the Kang War and stuff like that is good, but it's one big story arc. It's
okay.
And then as soon as that's done, it's back to being pretty mid.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to sidetrack. I just...
No worries. That discussion
this
was
is...
more interesting than this comic. This
but
comic
it is
pure filler.
It is one of those things. And DC was just as guilty. Even Image, right? They came up with some great concepts like Cyber Force and, you know, so on and so forth, but just never really seemed to be able to kick it in the arse enough to make it, you know, really good.
Yeah. And I think anything that has to produce one issue every month or so, there's going to be filler issues. It happens with TV shows. It happens with movies that try to do a big franchise thing. Some
it
of the movies just
don't. It happens with podcasts that losers like us do. This is a filler episode, guys.
No. This is just all filler.
Okay. Well, yeah. So.
We're talking about 70-year-old comics. Nothing important is going to happen here.
Less flavor, more filling. That's us. That's us, guys. You know, bland white boys talking about fucking comics. Yeah. More filler.
So anyway, back on topic.
It's true.
3 stars.
I gave it 2.
Back on topic, 2.
I had fun.
How the hell could you give it 3?
Because it's all a fight, and it was fairly fun.
No,
okay.
Fuck this comic.
Yeah, Ryan, what you get?
I didn't hate it, but I didn't like it. It was a 2 for sure.
Yeah, in your face, Flanders.
I can't justify
I'm not going to argue that it deserves better, because I think it probably sits right about a 2.5.
I'm going to look.
2.64. It's 2.64 is the average.
I am not going to... I could not justify getting a comic that focused so much on Giant Man of 3.
There you go.
He was captured for like 12 pages. That's a great comic.
Yeah.
It was pushing a 4 until Lost Freedom. He just wasn't in half the comic.
Yeah, and that was the better half of the comic.
It was. It probably would have been a 2 if he was there for the entire time.
Such a weak start.
Anyway, let's get back on track or we'll be here all day.
Speaking of, Strange Tales number 128, the A story is next. Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch, this one is titled. This one is, of course, written by good old Stan Lee, our favorite. Dick Ayers and Steve Ditko are apparently on Earth together, but I don't think that's true. I think it's just Dick Ayers. Inks by Frank, the last name I'm not going to try to say. Cover art by Jack Kirby. Artie Simic's on letters. October 1964 release date. This is a 12-page story, and I will take us away with this one. You don't need to strap in for this one. It won't be long.
Strap in or strap on? Just asking.
I mean, Quicksilver is in this issue.
Ooh. Dissing the Quicksilver.
Doesn't even deserve it that much yet.
Yeah, it's more in Cap's Kooky Quartet that he really... deserves it.
I've actually been liking Quicksilver's characterization.
Yeah, I like him so far. It's when he gets into a cunt-off with Hawkeye in Avengers that
I
changes.
Love the part where he gets gunned down, you know, because he's been sick. Right? You know, he lies there bleeding. That was my favorite part.
Okay, anyways. Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch. Here we go. Wanted to be free of Magneto's rule. Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch decide they should seek the aid of heroes in the United States. Traveling to New York, the two go to seek the help of the Fantastic Four. Unfortunately, the Finn and the Human Torch are the only ones home. That is pretty unfortunate.
Yeah, the idiots are there.
And they have just seen a news bulletin identifying the two mutants as members of Magneto's Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. A fight soon breaks out that ends with both sides growing weary. Afterward, the two mutants decide that they're the safest by Magneto's side, and the two Fantastic Four members allow them to leave. That's literally it.
Yeah, this is another fight issue.
Okay.
Yeah, October and November 1964 were, they were struggling for actual...
I don't think they had many ideas right now, and so they're just like, what if we had these people fight these people?
I mean, this was actually a fun issue.
It was good.
This one actually deserves a 3, unlike the last one.
Yeah, I also gave this a 3. Although,
This one technically has a lower average rating. By
knowing 0-4. The future, I kind of wanted to retroactively dock it to a 2, but that didn't seem fair. Just because, I mean, this isn't really spoilers for anyone who knows remotely Marvel history, but they go back to Magneto, and I don't think there's even another Brotherhood story before they leave again and join the Avengers. So it kind of takes away the impact of them choosing to side with Magneto if it's just immediately undone in their next appearance. There's at most one Brotherhood story after this.
I really liked both Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch's characterization of this one. This issue does, of course, make Finn and Human Torch look like idiots, but this title does that all the time.
So. I was going to say, there's not many times where they don't.
Yeah, especially the best thing in Human Torch stories are ones where they just admit that these guys are idiots. Because, like, Ben's a character I really like, but he's an idiot.
Yeah,
even
to be fair,
well-written Ben is
thing.
Kind of an idiot.
Yeah, no, I've always liked the Thing. I always thought he was one of the more fun characters.
I think one of the main reasons I like him is because he's kind of an idiot, but not in, like, a shitty, terrible writing way. Although here he is also in a shitty, terrible writing way.
Yeah, but he was the only one they drew with proper rock-hard abs. Okay, fine.
Fuck.
You miss me when I'm not here.
That went over like Rock Hard Juice Robinson.
Oh my god.
Ryan hates him, which is why I said that.
Yeah.
Oh.
Next title before this deteriorates any further.
Let's go to the B story of Strange Tales number 128. But... titled The Demon's Disciple.
All right. Who wants a long story? Because you're not fucking getting it here.
Stan Lee writing this bad boy, of course. Steve Ditko on art. This one's got Artie Simic on the letters, and this is a 10-page story, and we'll send Bill off to read this one.
All right. Doctor Strange is visited by a disciple of a mystic known as the Demon, but the demon causes the man to disappear. Tracking the demon to his lair, Doctor Strange is trapped in the Crimson Bands of Sidorak until he travels out of body and reads the demon's spells to learn a way to free himself. Doctor Strange bests the demon in mythical combat and casts a spell that makes the demon renounce the mystic arts for the purposes of evil.
Wow. Riveting.
They were hitting the fight issues hard here. Because this is just another straight-up fight.
First half of this podcast has been incredible.
Well, to be fair, and I this probably should be said in the light of the comic books in general at this point in time, they were drawing them for the fighting. You know, like, it was for the action and the, you know, the biff-bam-boom, right? So fight issue comics aren't necessarily that bad.
Yeah, and that's also something that needs to be said. Even with more modern comics, with the more advanced storyline, fight issues still exist. And they're good because, I mean, half the reason you read the comics is for the action.
Or the body count, like True Romance, titles like that, you know.
Yes, but the fighting is usually far more painful in those ones.
Oh,
I've read entirely too much Patsy Walker to be surprised that Buzz eventually decided he wanted to kill her.
Yeah.
But, no, it's just unfortunate that sometimes in the order, they clump up.
Yeah.
Because they don't really advance storylines that much, so they just get stuck in little clumps when we need to get those comics moved past.
Yeah, well, you know, part of this podcast at some point in the future is going to have to be about the Bill read these titles, so you don't have to. And then we're going to make Bill sit there and talk about all of these friggin' romance comics that he's had to read to complete the order.
Yeah, I can't.
Don't get me started on the funny animals.
Oh, yes. And we're not Jekyll and Jekyll funny.
Okay, if I ever have to hear the name Droopy Dog one more time, I'm going to murder someone. The worst thing was, here's some little inside baseball about that. The Funny Animal Order got pulled into 616 continuity in 2019 when Ziggy Pig and Silly Seal showed up in Latveria in the special. I was already past the point when most of those comics happened in my expanded order. So I not only had to read all that shit, I had to read all 1,100 comics of it at once.
Oh, the things we do for podcasts that nobody watches.
That's not even for the podcast.
No, that was just for my own sunk cost fallacy.
Oh, God.
Anyway, pulling back to Strange Tales,
yeah,
I gave it 3 stars. This same as the other ones, it was a fight issue,
yeah,
inconsequential, but fairly fun to read.
Yeah, I gave it 3 as well. I'd even argue that I almost enjoyed the last one a little more than this, even though this has a higher average rating on the site.
I did enjoy the last one more than this.
Or the next one
more than this.
But yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyways.
This, I'd say, was one of the weakest Doctor Stranges we've covered so far.
I agree with that. Moving on to Fantastic Four, number 34, titled A House Divided. Oh, I just saw my rating again. This one is probably one of the more divisive Fantastic Fours that we've gotten to so far.
Okay.
Which is funny, considering this is about the Fantastic Four being divided.
It's also the first comic we're going to cover today that something actually happens in.
Yeah. but you might argue if that's a good thing or not. This one's written by Stan Lee. We got art by Jack Kirby, of course. Chick Stone is on inks. Jack Kirby is on the cover. Letters by Artie Simic. November 1964 release date. This is a 20-page story, and Bill will take us away with this one.
All right. Well, the FF comment on the Thing's latest gift from the Yancey Street gang, a Beatles wig. Put a pin in that. It will show up again later. Greedy millionaire Gregory Gideon makes a bet with his competitors. If he cannot defeat the Fantastic Four within a week, he will forfeit his entire fortune to them. But if he succeeds, he gains their wealth. Gideon's plan starts by convincing the Thing that Reed is really a Skrull imposter and convincing Sue that Johnny is a robot imposter created by Dr. Doom. Although they clash with each other, they soon realize that they were tricked. They rush to the Baxter building, unaware that Gideon's men have set up Dr. Doom's time machine on the floor so that whoever crosses it gets sent to another time. Gideon's plan ultimately fails because his son Tommy is a big Fantastic Four fan, and when he learns that his father is going to kill his favorite heroes, the boy goes to the Baxter building to warn them. Tommy walks through the time machine trap, and though the Thing tries to save the boy, the two are transported to another era. After the Fantastic Four round up the crooks and turn off the time machine, Gideon arrives and begs Reed Richards to bring back his son and is willing to pay anything to get Tommy back. When the boy appears safe and sound, having been returned to the present when Reed turned off the device, Gideon realizes that in his mad quest for ultimate wealth, he neglected the most valuable thing he had, his family. After listening to an appeal from his wife, Gideon swears to give his fortune to charity. The Fantastic Four let the Gideon family go to rebuild their troubled family. Okay, that's a little misleading in the end there, because Gideon was arrested for what he did. Part of his rebuilding was that he had to actually serve time.
Okay. I was riveted.
So, I off air I said this was decent earlier, but I actually gave this a 2. There's parts of this I liked, but the overall execution of this issue landed the 2 that it got, because I like there's kind of a good moral fucking story in there with the Gideon character in a way, but I kind of, a lot of this issue was kind of dumb.
It's a Stan Lee moral too, so it's delivered by brick to the face.
Yeah, exactly.
I also gave this a 2. I mean, it was fine. It was nice to see them try something a little different, except that they've done the Fantastic Four breakup like 3 times already.
Yeah.
This is one of the weaker FF issues so far.
Yeah, it didn't make a lot of sense. One of the big problems, and I think that's because they haven't really leaned into the shared universe that much yet, but the fact that you have someone as wealthy as Gideon, who at this point literally basically controlled the entire world through wealth except for like 2 other really rich guys, and that's why he was making the bet with them, so he'd basically control all of Earth's wealth if he won the bet. Which completely forgets that Tony Stark exists.
Yeah.
We've been trying to forget Tony Stark exists for a long time. Just so you know.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, he's shown up in Fantastic Four before. It's not like they're not aware of him.
Yeah. We're very, very aware of him.
I guess if they were smart and leaned into the shared universe even more, they could have mentioned that this is when Tony Stark is believed to be dead.
But yeah. He still would have had to basically have bought out Tony's company. Like, if this story happened nowadays, they would have built to it for like a year by having him in the background of a bunch of books amassing wealth, just as like a thing that will be built on in the future.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
And so to just have this guy show up and we just have to accept that he has all this wealth and power, but we've never heard of him before, it really hurt the story.
Honestly, if they did this now in a format like that, it could actually probably be pretty good.
Yeah, the premise isn't the worst thing. It's just...
Well, that's why I said it's the execution of this issue as a whole that landed it to that it got. Because there's good stuff in there that could be pretty decent if done in a better way.
Okay.
But anyways, we could better move on because we got to get to Dan's favorite comic. It is Amazing Spider-Man, issue number 21.
Oh, you fucking cunts.
This one is titled, Where Flies the Beetle?
It's a bad sign when a Beetle story is the best story we covered this
best
week.
Comic of the week. And this is honestly probably one of the weaker Spider-Mans we've covered too. So far.
Probably about it. This is up there with the robot in Peter's high school.
It's probably a bottom 5, if I was guessing. This one's, of course, written by Stan Lee, art and inks by Steve Ditko, cover art by Steve Ditko. Andy Yankus on colors, his first credit of the order.
His last two, I don't recognize that name. Oh no, he's done 170 comics. And it's actually his third credit.
Is it?
He colored Amazing Fantasy and Spider-Man number 1's A story.
That's fucking crazy.
Welcome he back. Apparently,
crazy,
man.
Welcome back.
He did a bunch more, a bit more Spider-Man. Like, he's not a regular. He shows up in 66 again in issue 43 and then 122. And then he starts doing a bunch of X-Men in 1977 when they start using him regularly.
Oh, you're almost there.
Yeah, I actually am. And then he's on, like, Shogun Warriors, Micronauts, Contest of Champions.
Oh, so all their C titles.
Pretty much. He shows up here and there. I mean, everything I've seen that he's colored, he's has been so far has been re-released with the digital colors, so I have no idea how good he actually is. Fair. I'll find out when I get to some of those C titles that they haven't bothered to properly digitize.
This one was released in November 1964. Oh, Sam Rosenthal, by the way. 20-page story. And
yeah,
I will
can't
take
forget
this
Sam.
One.
Sam. Stan. Of course. Whatever his fucking name was.
The letter is to serve their credit.
Oh, yes. I've read stuff lettered by bad letterers. Yeah. They deserve their credit.
Oh, they do. Absolutely. That may be one of the most unsung heroes of comic books.
Oh, for sure.
Are the letterers.
And the main two that we have right now in this era both are really good and deserve their credit.
Yeah, Sam and Artie are some of the best artists they have with Marvel right now.
So anyways, into the synopsis we go. Abner Jenkins, of course the Beetle, is released from prison after serving a sentence, and he plots his revenge on the Human Torch who last sent him there. Oh yes, by the way, Human Torch guest stars in this issue. Johnny Storm reads the newspaper and decides to find him before it's too late, but can't find him much to the annoyance of Dory, his girlfriend. Johnny then has to promise her not to flame on for 24 hours or else it's over.
Dory, yes, this really is basically a Strange Tales story.
Pretty much, with added Spider-Man, which is why it's a bit better. After some jealousy and relationship drama ensues, Pete decides to rile up Johnny Storm by making Dory swoon over Spider-Man as well. Yet as he reaches her house, he runs into the Beetle and begins to fight when he sees his intentions aren't for good. Dory sees the fight and calls Johnny, but Johnny sees it as a trick to get him to flame on. The Beetle snatches Dory as bait for the Human Torch, and Spider-Man gives chase. Johnny shows up at her house just to humor her and sees the house as a wreck and realizes Dory was telling the truth after all. He chases after Spider-Man, figuring that he was involved. The Human Torch decides to fight Spider-Man instead of hearing him out and only realizes the truth when he sees the Beetle flying nearby with Dory in his hands. The Torch and Spidey work together in cornering the Beetle in an abandoned housing complex, and once wrapped up in Robin is ready for the police. That's it. And that actually leaves out a little bit of stuff where they are still suspicious of Spider-Man after he helps save Dory, and not only is the Torch the only one that was suspicious to begin with, Dory says that she thinks Spider-Man was involved even though she fucking saw him fighting the goddamn Beetle in her goddamn house and trying to save her.
But she also keeps whining that Johnny isn't anything like Peter, who she liked.
This comic is fun, also dumb.
Yeah, it's also the site of one of the first major retcons in the Order.
Really?
Dory has no clue who Peter is when he shows up at her house. Despite the fact that he was at the party in Spider-Man 8's B story, the one that we don't talk about because it's so terrible and rapey. But they also decided that the comic was terrible, so they're just ignoring that it happened now.
Could we do that with all of these titles? Just ignore the fact that they happened? It would make this podcast a lot more interesting.
I actually scrubbed that fucking story from... I forgot there was a B story in issue number 8 until you just said that.
I'm sorry I reminded you of it, because it's
real that's
my
least favorite Spider-Man story. But anyways...
It's the worst Spider-Man story we've read up to this point.
Yeah. It's closely followed by the A story in issue number 8.
I don't think it's that close. I would put the A story probably in second worst spot at this point, but I think there's a pretty wide gap between those two.
It is a pretty wide gap, and I'd even say there might even be one in between the two, but still.
It's probably this one.
Well, I hated the issue 2 story with the Tinkerer 2.
That's fair. Either way, this was a 3-star story.
I gave it. This one squeaks away with 3 for me as well.
It was there. I read it. I didn't hate it. That's really the nicest I can be about it.
It's got Spider-Man's art with Steve Ditko.
I really like the way he does the Torch, especially on the cover.
Yeah. Honestly, if they just gave Steve Ditko the whole Strange Tales, it'd probably be pretty enjoyable. But
yeah, he can. He's proved with Strange that he can generally script something that's decently readable.
But anyways, yeah, I mean, this was, like we've already said, this was a pretty low-tier Spider-Man story for what we've covered so far, so. Yeah. Well, let's move on to the next comic.
And Spider-Man will stay pretty high quality up until Gary Conway gets onto it in the 70s. So probably still over 100 issues of decently good Spider-Man.
Yeah. Strange Tales number 129, the A story is next, which is titled, simply titled, The Terrible Trio. Remember those guys?
You can drop the first and third words and it's also accurate.
Stan Lee is the writer on this. Dick Ayers is the artist, the best part of this comic. Frankie Giacola is the inker. Jack Kirby is on the cover. Artie Simic letters. November 1964 release date, a 12-page story, and Dan will take us away for this whopping synopsis.
And I just want to make note that we're on the downslope right now, immediately before Strange Tales, at least the Torch side, drives off a fucking cliff.
Yeah, okay, so sit back, kids, relax, grab something to eat while I go through this. The synopsis for The Terrible Trio. When the Torch learns that the Terrible Trio are on the loose again, he cuts a golf date with Doris short in order to search for them.
Doris
the trio get the
I think trio... this might be her last appearance, or she'll have like one or two more.
Dan, we're just trying to drag this out, buddy. Just work with us.
It's okay. It's okay. I understand. I do. Oh, God. The trio get the drop on the Torch and manage to defeat him and tie him down. Too bad he didn't have, like, flame powers and he could burn the ropes, right? You know, that.
Oh, they're made out of asbestos because everything in 1964 Manhattan is made out of asbestos and Torch stories.
Yeah. However, not before he calls the Thing for help, who is also similarly captured. The two are bound to the railroad Jesus Christ, what is this, Rocky and Bullwinkle?
No, but I don't remember what show they're referencing. I don't remember what show they're referencing, but they talk about it extensively in the comic, and I'm not going back to look it up.
Gee, Rocky, what are we going to do?
Perils of Pauline. That's it.
Yes.
Finn directly references it. He says it out loud.
Oh, they reference it like 5 times in this comic. Clearly, they had been watching it and just had to script the comic, so they quickly whipped this out.
Yeah. There's another Boris and Natasha. So, Boris and Natasha and the third person have the two bound to the railroad tracks. When the oncoming train arrives, the Thing is able to stop it with his feet because the laws of physics do not apply to the Fantastic Four. Breaking free, the two heroes quickly capture the trio. And, yeah, that's about it.
Didn't you hear they lost physics in space?
They do. In space, no one can hear you do math.
So this comic sucked.
Believe it
until
or not.
Until I read the rest of the run of... until I read the rest of the Human Torch run that's still coming up. And then I started to appreciate this comic.
Oh.
Because it's not as bad as the rest of them.
Jokes. The real truth is Bill's also a big Perils and Pauline fan. Oh, fuck.
This barely got a 2.
Yeah. I gave this a solid 2. This was pretty shit, but not the worst thing. Not a Giant Man issue yet. So, yeah.
Oh, don't worry. The Bouncing Ball of Doom is coming up.
Let's move on to the... Oh, by the way, at the end of the story, we are promised that a new artist will be taking over the Human Torch stories for next issue.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because it's death in a death spiral now, so they're pulling Dick Ayers off to work on good stuff.
Yeah.
So moving on to the last story of this week's issue, the episode, is the B story of Strange Tales number 129, which is titled Beware, Tibero, the Tyrant of the Sixth Dimension. We've got, written by Don Rico, art by Steve Ditko, and Sam Rosen is on letters, and this is a 10-page story, and Bill will take this one away.
Yeah, Stan still scripted this one.
Yeah,
it's
he's
just,
still like the editor and stuff.
Well, he also plotted it, rather, that's the word I want, and he just didn't have time to write the script, so he stuck Rico on it.
Yeah, brace yourselves, because this is actually a huge write-up.
Yeah, this is the longest write-up we have this week.
Okay,
this
Bill.
Is also Don Rico's last writing credit in the order. He had those two Iron Mans earlier, and now this.
Oh, shit. That's kind of
okay.
Funny.
I'm stalling, but this is actually better than the title would indicate.
Okay.
Because it sounds like it should be a one from that title. Although asked to appear on a TV show called The 12th Hour to discuss black magic, Doctor Strange has refused, so the show begins airing live at midnight without him. Since Strange had refused their invitation, the three panelists reject him as an authority on the world of the supernatural and declare that black magic exists only in fiction. As proof, they bring out an effigy called the Screaming Idol that was excavated in Peru and state that it's only a pagan idol that does not contain any mystic powers. At that moment, the studio is struck by a sudden blackout, and when the lights are restored, the three scientists have disappeared, causing the station to begin airing a travelogue instead. When the studio police search the entire building but find nothing, director Mr. James suspects that the idol might be responsible, but doesn't believe that calling in the police would help, because they'd just think it was a publicity stunt. Joe suggests that they call the one person who might take them seriously. After arriving at the studio, Doctor Strange asks that the scene be restaged by darkening the studio. When this is done, Strange's enchanted amulet enables him to see a technician vanishing into the aura surrounding the idol. Strange casts a mystic shield around the idol and takes it to another room where he contacts the Ancient One for help. His master identifies the idol as an effigy of Tibero, who once ruled on Earth in the distant past, until he and the civilization who worshipped him vanished. The fact that his idol has finally appeared means that Tibero is ready to strike.
Bum, bum, bum.
Armed with this knowledge, Doctor Strange momentarily removes the mystic shield around the idol, just long enough to enable its power to transport him to the sixth dimension, where he appears before Tibero himself. Although he had hoped to avoid attracting Strange's attention, Tibero now realizes that he must deal with Strange before he can continue. While Tibero identifies himself as the Spirit of Decay, who takes command when a civilization has reached a crisis point, Strange, believing that his power might lie in his wand, secretly mentally influences Tibero to put down his wand and fight without it. Once Tibero has done so, and Strange has removed his cloak, the two begin to battle only with their physical strength. However, after finding that he has underestimated his enemy, Tibero resorts to more drastic measures, and they begin fighting with black magic. In this battle, Strange manages to defeat Tibero after tricking him into wasting much of his power in fighting an illusion. When Strange has made it so that he cannot use his wand, Tibero surrenders but declares that he will return if he detects further decay of the civilization of Earth. Strange accepts this but demands that he release his four captives. Back on Earth, where only a minute has passed since Strange disappears, he and the missing four men appear out of the idol in front of two network officials. Now convinced that black magic exists, the men eagerly plan to put on a show starring Doctor Strange, but he, believing that it is not meant for mortals to know so much of what transpires in the mystic dimensions, casts a spell of forgetfulness over them all. As the spell is cast, time goes back until the moment when the studio was blacked out, but this time, when the lights come on only a few seconds later, the three panelists have not disappeared. As they state that black magic exists only in fiction, no one notices Doctor Strange watching from the shadows.
Okay.
This was surprisingly decent.
Yeah, it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah, they were going for a pretty out there concept with this one, and it kind of worked.
Yeah, it did kind of work, to be fair.
I really like the concept of this. I just wish a better writer had handled it.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I'm going. It's kind of like a bit like Fantastic Four, except this one came off a little better than Fantastic Four did.
Oh yeah, I gave this one a 3, and it was probably my favorite story of the week.
Yeah, I can see why.
It was less offensive to our brains than Spider-Man was, so in a way it was the best comic of the week.
Yeah, I think Spider-Man was objectively a little better because Spider-Man has a supporting cast.
That's what I was getting at.
Whereas Doctor Strange really doesn't have a supporting cast at this point, other than Wong and the Ancient One. And Wong's basically just there as someone he can give exposition to.
Yeah, he's an info dump.
And the Ancient One likewise does that to Strange. Yeah. So they're both just means of giving information. But I enjoyed this one a little more just because they were doing something creative with it. And it was pretty fun. And I really liked the idea of, you know, trying to get Doctor Strange onto a reality TV show to prove the existence of magic.
Yeah. Yeah, it could have been a lot worse, I guess, is the only positive thing I can say about it. Like, they actually decided to do something a bit different on the edges. You know, the concept of bringing, you know, a TV interview, or bringing Strange to a TV interview, is a little bit different than what they do normally with the superheroes, you know, and having him go, no, fuck off. You guys can't handle this. Right? Because the one thing about Strange is it's not just a superpower. You know, he's not made out of rock or can turn or can burn. Or
he has a skill set that most people don't have, but he doesn't actually have any superpowers.
Yeah, he's just simply manipulating, you know, magic. He's not super in and of himself, and you know, it is nice to kind of always sort of step away from all of that, because even the X-Men, you know, as fun as they can be,
really at this point.
Well, no, not at this point, but they, you know, X-Men really always kind of had moments where it was fun, and this is just a whole different side of comics, right? And I can see where this led to, you know, sort of the darker, you know, Dracula titles and stuff like that. That's all I have to say about that.
Well, if you can't have fun with an with an analog for racism, where can you?
I didn't think it was that bad. I really
no,
didn't.
it was decent. I guess we'll tease next week's titles for next episode, and then we'll go into our close. So next week, we will go back to Sergeant Fury with a couple issues of it, as we cover Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos number 14, which is about the Blitzkrieg squad of Baron Strucker. And then we will go into Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos number 15, which, well, they, I guess this one's about some child soldiers by the looks of it, so that's fun.
Oh, goody.
And then we will go into
Avengers. Oh, I know what that one is. Yeah, that one's actually kind of important.
It looks like it could be.
They add a new character that's fairly regular for a while there.
Oh, nice. Avengers number 13 sees another character debut, actually, as we meet Count Nefaria. And then
we were trying to get people to watch this.
Well, you know, they can't all be good. Then Avengers number 14 is apparently is to prove that even Avengers can die, but I have a feeling that's not going to stick. Then we will go into Fantastic Four number 35, which, oh, okay. Another important character debut, actually.
Yeah, I really like this one.
Yeah, okay. I'm not going to spoil that one, actually, even though it was on the cover.
It's Dragon Man.
It is Dragon Man.
I will.
This whole episode is Dragon Man.
If it's on the cover, it's not a spoiler.
Yeah, that's. I realized as I was saying, there was no point.
There is another even more important thing than Dragon Man in there that I will not spoil.
Fair enough. Then we will end.
Don't read the issue notes before this one, Ryan.
Okay. Then we will read off of Daredevil number 6, which sees Daredevil trapped by the Fellowship of Fear. Yeah. Okay.
There's an important character debuting in that one, too.
You wouldn't think it, but sure. And then this actually, another reason that that one is important is because it's the last issue that Daredevil has his original costume.
So, yeah. I mean, Ox on the cover really doesn't sell that anything important happens in that one, but there is actually an important debut.
So yeah, that will be next week.
Although the importance of that debut doesn't really pay off till issue 91. Which is the next time that character shows up. He becomes an important element of Daredevil's lore, but Mr. Fear is not well used at first.
Okay. Well, let us go into the closing stretches of this week's podcast before Dan dissociates anymore.
Yeah, we're really sorry about this podcast, guys.
This was very much a filler week.
Then don't look at what we have in 2 weeks.
But, way to sell it, buddy. Whoa. Dude.
Yeah.
When I clicked on the Daredevil issue to see what one it was, the next two comics showed up in my upcoming line.
Upcoming line, yeah.
And I realized what we're going into then. On the bright side, after we get through that, no more Johnny Torch.
So we should start every episode of this with an apology to the people watching it? Is that what you're saying?
We might be saying
no, the kind of people that will watch this like this shit.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
Anyway, people, if you're watching this on YouTube, the whole zero of you, please do like, subscribe, comment, and even share if you would like to. We're also available on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and of course Spotify, and let us know why Perils and Pauline was your favorite this week.
I was trying to figure out which one you were going to pick for the shit issue. I wasn't expecting you to go for just like a TV show that's constantly referenced. I think it's a TV show. It might be a movie series.
The Perils of Pauline, I think it was a serial, wasn't it?
I don't know. Literally, the only time I've ever heard of it was on this show, in this issue, and I didn't care enough to look it up.
I think Dan might be right. I looked it up a little bit ago to make sure.
It's a 1914 film.
Okay, it is.
And it is a serial, just so you know. 1914 serial.
It's from 1914? Jesus, yeah. What was Stan doing watching it?
If you search the name of it, a lot of different years come up, but 1914 is the first one.
Okay, here you go.
Oh, okay, the serial must have still been going. Yeah. Because why the hell was Stan referencing, at the time, a 50-year-old movie?
Yeah, it was. Pauline was played by Pearl White, just so you know. So it would have been a silent serial. 1914 American melodrama film serial produced by William Randolph Hearst and released by the Eclectic Film Company, shown in biweekly installments, featuring Pearl White as the title character, an ambitious young heiress with an independent nature and a desire for adventures.
I think this is the, from what I understand from the context in this comic, it's the movie serial where the trope of the heroine always being tied to train tracks comes from.
Potentially, you don't know.
I don't know.
I'm still going with Rocky and Bullwinkle
Natasha. It had a sound serial for 1933 with a different plot by Paramount Pictures, and then that turned into something in 1947 back to the title Perils of Pauline.
Yeah,
and then,
starring Betty Hutton.
And then it gets a relaunch a bit in by Universal again in 1967, which is a few years away at this time, for as an updated comedy.
Cool.
Maybe it was. They must have just been watching it recently.
Ooh,
or maybe.
Excuse me.
Jesus. Maybe news of the new one came out. I don't know.
No, you know
what? Yeah, it is commonly located, associated with the 1914 film serial, The Perils of Pauline.
Yeah.
But this is probably due to confusion. No one knows since neither the serial nor the scripts remain.
I can't believe
actually, that's not strictly true.
That's what TV Tropes said.
Yeah, TV Tropes isn't particularly accurate, though.
Can't believe there. We just...
There's a 1947 version for you. That's straight off YouTube.
Yeah, this was talking about the 1914. They said elements of it remain, but not the whole thing.
Well, like they said they did a different plot for the 1933 one. Yeah. By Universal.
Why are we
Studios.
Doing such a deep dive on this anyway?
I don't know. That's what I was going to say, but you guys kept going.
Yeah, we did.
But anyways, let us dive out of this hole we've dug ourselves in and end this episode.
Yeah, let's get out of here and go watch Perils of Pauline.
We will see. That's not what we're doing. We will see you on the next one.
As soon as we shut this down, we all get together with popcorn on the couch and we watch these really bad 1914 serials.
Oh, fuck off. I'm watching TNA's weekly pay-per-view 4.
Well, okay, these two wankers actually watch professional wrestling.
God damn it. Anyways,
I prefer something slightly more intellectual like Velma or, you know, Cleopatra, the queen, you know, or something else a little more, you know, involved.
It's been months that I've not heard one person put the words intellectual and Velma together.
Well, it's no worse than the friggin' Cleopatra miniseries. Oh my God, they literally missed everything. Historically, it's more inaccurate than Braveheart.
Wow.
Like, and Braveheart's a drama, right? Braveheart is not purported to actually be factual.
Oh yeah, Braveheart, but it's not factual.
No, but they claim that this is a documentary.
And yeah, I've heard those claims.
Literally more inaccurate than Braveheart.
That's impressive.
It's horrifying. Anyone who knows anything about Egyptian history is just squirming over this. It's so fucking bad. I've never, ever seen anything on Netflix that rivals what shit this is. Oh my fuck, it's bad.
See, there's your first problem. On Netflix.
Yeah, but even Netflix has had its wins, guys.
Oh, yeah. It's not all bad, but...
This is just, like, this is staggering in how bad it is. Like, how inaccurate.